This is the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. I'm Ann Clark, a member of the Commonwealth Club and chair of the Environment and Natural Resources member-led forum. Our program tonight is The Science of Open Spaces with Charles Curtin, Senior Fellow for the Center for Natural Resources Environmental Policy from the University of Montana, Missoula. Ecologist and conservationist, Charles will share stories of his experience working to conserve the economy, ecology, and the culture of large open spaces. Charles's latest book is The Science of Open Spaces, Theory and Practice for Conserving Large Complexes, Conserving Large Complex Systems, Island Press Publisher. We're really pleased to have Charles here, and we welcome him to San Francisco. So let's give a round of applause to our visitor from Montana.
Thank you. Appreciate you coming, particularly on such a glorious evening. Let me get this going here. So what I'll be talking about tonight really follows, in some ways, the progression of the book Science of Open Spaces, which I really wrote in response to, well, years ago, I guess it was 09, 010, I was teaching at MIT, and I had a course, these wonderful environmental professionals from all over the world, and it was all about the practice of conservation and really linking conservation with complexity theory, with ecology. And what I found is there really weren't any resources one could use for this. There were some of the original literature. There was so a few articles and things, but there really wasn't a good book. And that book, those books and resources that did exist often were quite technical and weren't very accessible. So I started this by trying to write a book on, again, this complexity in ecology and policy. And my editor looked at it and said, well, you know, if you made it more user-friendly, a little bit easier to read, a little bit more narrative, a lot more people would read it. So I wrote the first draft in about a year, and then took about 4 years to, this must be on a timer, unbeknownst to me. But it took years to re-edit to make it accessible. So the idea is to have something that really reached the broad audience. In particular, maybe perhaps give you the punchline, then go through the narrative as you go through them tonight. Really, as an ecologist, what I found, even beginning with my graduate work years ago, that a lot of our science is really, I'll just ignore this until the time comes, our science has really evolved to address fairly short-term, fairly specific issues. In other words, small scale, both in time and space. In other words, it's very good at getting a job or getting tenure. It's not very good at addressing the kind of very complex issues we deal with today, things like climate change and some of the work I've done, for example, where it can take 20 years just to get the kind of data you need to really understand these complex problems. In addition, the disciplinary boundaries are you really have to transcend. It no longer really works when you're dealing with something like climate change or other kinds of environmental change to just do ecology or just economics. So this very much is an effort to span a range of different disciplines. So with that, I guess I'll take them from the start. And one of the first things, points I want to make is that in ecology, what really drives so much of what we do and drives so much of conservation is the species area curve. And I hope you can see the red ink writing up top there. But species area curve basically says that everything else being equal, larger places have more species. And of course, in our increasingly degraded and disturbed world, the opposite also occurs, that the smaller the space, the fewer species you have. And this really drives so much of what we do in conservation. Often the ecologists at University of Arizona, Michael Rosenzweig, call this the tyranny of space, and that basically, again, there's no way around the space issue, that essentially for species to persist for a long period of time, you need large spaces. And we're increasingly finding that not only that, but it takes years for what this causes, the relaxation to occur, where there's a wonderful study done just a couple of years ago in Europe showing that the best predictor of species diversity is not current fragmentation, but actually fragmentation occurred 100 or more years ago. So it takes often things a long time to basically collapse down. So in other words, often you may have a park that looks perfectly healthy, and yet a lot of those species are consigned to death because this area simply is long enough or large enough for those facts to happen. So what this image, the slide showing here, is that you have a somewhat larger space, there's more species. As you fragment it, you get fewer species, and again, this tyranny of space really drives this. So what this means, then, is that conservation and conservation science is really, I look at it as being very much really the core issue of, it doesn't matter whether you're doing captive rearing species or whether you're putting in road crossings. So much of conservation in ecology is really trying to make a degraded, disturbed planet seem a lot larger than it is. You're really trying to game the system. It really boils down to creating either large-scale solutions or creating the illusion of large-scale solutions. And that's why this phrase of the science of open spaces is really after creating open spaces. So we've gone from really viewing things as essentially a park-based approach where you figure that species inhabit these protected areas. And a century ago, or a little more now, a place like Yellowstone at over 2 million acres was thought to be large enough to sustain the species inside it. And what we found is that instead, they're not big enough. That, in fact, I'll show you some slides later on, that they're only a fraction of the size they need to be. So increasingly, we're going to a more integrated approach, realizing that you can't just protect species. You have to protect cultures. You have to protect the economy. That, in some ways, while we often for a century thought that if you just did good science, everything else would follow. And increasingly we're realizing the opposite. That actually, you have to get the social system right. You have to get the you have to get the economic system right. And if you get all those pieces right, then the science will follow. But science follows good social policy, not the other way around. And I'll hope to show you some examples of that a little bit later. So in this movement toward large-scale systems, you basically, or we're now increasingly looking at even the size of states or size of whole continents, and basically this green area is those connected areas in California. But again, connectivity at very large scales requires thinking about a lot more into species. Again, you have to conserve and sustain that social, basically the social fabric which underlies that. But of course, the problem is that when you go up in scale, a lot of things change. And so I use this diagram, these little toy locomotives, to show that as you go up in scale, really, even though these may be all identical models of the same thing, same little toy engine, they're actually quite different. You might imagine that the ball bearings, the engine, everything is different in this engine than that engine. So while they may look the same, as you cross scales, there's nonlinear changes occurring. Again, everything, from engine size, ball bearings, as I said a moment ago, everything's changing across scales. And so that the same thing occurs in much more complex systems out in the real world, where at the same time you go from, say, a park, a small park, to, say, a continent or part of a continent, and all these other factors start to come into play. You get all these ecosystems, goods and services, supporting services. You got the legacies, environmental drivers. So a myriad of factors come to play, and so that's why I use this phrase complexity in the title of my book, because increasingly we're realizing that if you don't think about complex systems and complex interactions, as you move up in scales, you very quickly get bitten by the reality out there, which is that all these dynamic interactions are occurring, whether you choose to recognize them or not. The most dramatic is as you go up in scale, you less and less have the luxury of avoiding dealing with people. When you're working with people, again, you move very rapidly out of the sphere of science into the sphere of cultural and other issues. So really, then I think of, again, people often focus on science, how you do science, or policy or practice, but really the reality is that they're all, I look at them all as being sort of same sides of the same issue, and that your system's totally enmeshed, and that really increasingly for effective science or conservation or practice, this is very odd, you are essentially having to span these different systems, and so that this boundary spanning is actually critical. And in other words, there's kind of an artificial distinction between looking at economic or ecological systems because they're very much enmeshed. So, boy, we've got a slide missing here for some reason. But one way to look at this is, for example, the outcome of funding. And that traditionally people have looked at funding, say, as being a single sort of bell curve where you say invest for, say, 3 to 5 years, and then you, after that, often funders will move on to different areas. But the problem with the whole way we look at funding is that while that may be optimal in terms of the internal strategy of the funding organization, it may be very much suboptimal in terms of the long-term outcomes. So a lot of my work has kind of suggested that if you took that same amount of investment and you spread it out longer, you actually get some additional benefits. And really what this is phrasing is that, in other words, so often when we're investing in funding or investing in science, we're here, where you get a lot of return, so there's the illusion of a lot of return benefit. But the problem is that you're in essence also always on a steep end of the curve, so you're always investing where the costs are highest and returns are lowest. And increasingly what you see when you start investing in long-term projects is that as you go out, that actually if you invest longer, you start getting other kinds of emergent outcomes. For example, if you just invest here, you will be totally a donor-driven system. The only way to sustain that is by external financial support. If you start working at a longer time scale or spatial scale, then you start doing things like working at rural development and starting to do things that sustain the process. And the point is to go from a donor-driven model to a self-funding model, because the slide I had up here that just seems to be missing was trying to point out that really, unfortunately, so much of our science funding and our conservation funding is a 3 to 5 year solution to a 100-year problem. In other words, your funding may last only about here, but you see it's going to take much, much longer to have real success, because keep in mind, success as a minimum is generational. It's going to take at least a decade or two, usually 2 decades, to see success, and you can't do it through this model that typically invests in only 3 to 5 years. And by the way, the same thing holds for science, particularly, again, these large, complex issues such as climate change, where there, too, you're dealing with issues take decades to solve. And so you cannot, again, solve a decadal problem through just a short-term bit of funding. So illustration I often use, sort of a corny illustration, but one that works a lot of students I teach, is, I don't know if any of you are follow Star Trek fans, but this Kabasha Maru. Anyone know this? No? Yeah, good. Okay, great. Good. So what this is that this is, again, one's from the Star Trek. Is Star Trek 3? Which one is it? 4? I forget. First one. Okay, thank you. Okay. Well, so first one, the reboot, and here we go. And the point is, I think it's a wonderful analogy to the way we do science, the problems we face in science, in that what happens here is Captain Kirk's one of a few Starfleet cadets to successfully solve this challenge. And the challenge is that you basically have to choose between losing your ship or failing your mission. I probably have it slightly, is that close enough? Yeah. It's a no-win scenario. And so what Captain Kirk does is, as he games the system, he reprograms computers so he creates a winnable solution where one didn't appear. Well, I would argue that in some ways we're faced with the same challenge in conservation. And kind of my point of writing the book is that we're faced with really an unwinnable situation as it currently exists. The rules of the game are essentially, again, we have a science that's really designed, it's great for getting tenure, but not very good to address large complex problems. We have funding that's very short-term for long-term complex problems. We've got siloed approach to science and conservation that don't really address the issues at hand. And so all those together mean that, again, we really have, I really like this quote from Einstein, which is kind of overused, but really hits the nail on the head, which is insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. In other words, you know, we've been dealt a hand that's really not as a losing hand. If you just look at the dynamics of fuel, sort of basic things I just talked about, again, you cannot sort, you know, address long-term complex problems with short-term simple solutions. It just doesn't work. And yet that's the way we really address so much of our science and conservation. Again, it's eminently good at addressing the rules of the game. It's eminently good at basically assigning success or failure. but it's not very good at addressing these large, complex problems we face. So the reason I wrote the book is to really, again, have a different way of looking at science and conservation. And by the way, I really look at those as being completely entwined, in that I really see theory, and I do, it's funny, my work I tend to do ends opposite end of spectrum. I do some pure theory, complexity theory, sort of applied physics, and I do some work that's very much just hands on the ground conservation. And you know, I think they're the same thing. Years ago, it's an amazing experience. I had, doing some workshops at Santa Fe Institute, which is a think tank in, outside Santa Fe for Nobel laureates and various folks. And we're talking about complex systems and dynamics, et cetera, et cetera. And then 3 days later, I was meeting a bunch of ranchers in southern Arizona. And, you know, I felt like the situation, was the models, the issues these groups were dealing with were almost the same. Again, one group had this quite complex, you know, jargon, and others didn't, but yet they're dealing with the same kinds of complexity. So the point is that people on the ground deal with immense complexity all the time. And so, again, a lot of these models apply. And so another way to put it is that the most sort of esoteric complex theory in some ways does a better job of explaining that reality out there than a lot of the more mainstream science theories, particularly in my home discipline of ecology, which, again, are very, they're beautiful, they're very elegant science, but they're quite simplified. So, in looking at science from space, is basically, it's complex-based, it's transdisciplinary, it's trans-system, and I'll be describing what that means in just a minute. So the first one is complexity-based, and the core, whole point of complexity is that systems are always much more in some of their parts, as in this case. But keep in mind, for example, that you know people use that phrase rocket science. Well, rocket science is fairly simple, actually. I mean, you think about people were able to get you know a person the moon back with you know less computational power than is probably in your iPod. Yet they were able to pull that off. Whereas you know natural systems, particularly large scales, again have these emergent outcomes which are phenomenally complex. Things happen you would not expect. They're much more in some of their parts. And yet, most of our models, both in ecology, in sociology, in economics, assume this model, a simple model, or a complicated model rather than a complex model. The second issue is one of being transdisciplinary. And I've talked about that a minute ago, that in essence, so often, you know, scientists, they do work together now. They didn't used to do even a decade or two ago. But it's often parallel play where people don't really interact. And they get in the same sandbox. But when in the same sandbox, they don't really interact. And so that what that means is that there's really a loss of opportunity. I think of, for example, in fisheries, I've worked in some where now we've got scientists and fishermen on the working together on, say, fishing vessels. But still the case where the fisherman drives the boat and the scientist takes data. They rarely talk. And so a lot of the point here is to really try and break down these institutional boundaries and really have people interact much more aggressively because it's really that trust fertilization that is so critical. Another way to put that is that so often the solutions to, say, an issue in ecology or in economics, are as easy. I mean, the easy solutions are already achieved in your home discipline. People have been thinking about it for decades or centuries. Whereas sometimes low-hanging fruit, the opportunities are actually going to be in another discipline. So, for example, with fisheries work, I found sometimes that I can get sociological data to inform me about, say, the impacts of change in fisheries management. Or I can get you can get ecological data. Well, the ecological data probably costs you $500,000 and a you know, large research ship, et cetera, et cetera. The sociological data may take two graduate students and a couple weekends of going around interviewing fishermen. So again, these are examples where it's really important to think about non-traditional and think about alternative ways of problem solving. So.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is The Science of Open Spaces with Charles Curtin, Senior Fellow for the Center for Natural Resources Environmental Policy, University of Montana, Missoula. Charles?
Thank you. So the next area to talk about quickly is being transboundary, and that often people tend to work in a single area, and they go very deep in a single area rather than working across multiple areas. What I find that so often is that you learn often more, again, from looking at your system through someone else's eyes. So over the years, a number of exchanges between Maasai and ranchers, between fishermen and ranchers. And again, this idea that so much of that richness, the opportunities really exist in taking someone else's perspective. So that's a second core area here is being transboundary. So not only are we transdisciplinary, we're transboundary. A third area that's really important is this paradox that it turns out if you look at science, our good data exists at two scales mostly. Again, this is a bit of a simplification, but by and large, our data exists at the meter scale, based on the scale smaller than the human, what you can sort of look at directly. Or it exists at the much larger scale, sort of satellite scale, planetary scale. And you think about, for example, when you look at a lot of, say, data of, say, climate change, where you say you look at a simulation of what may happen in Northern California, what they've actually done is they've taken a simulation from, say, the globe, and they've spliced off a little piece of that, essentially, for the area, and they've what's called downscaled to the area. The problem with that downscaling is that it's grossly simplified. A lot of the complexity is washed out of that data. So in other words, you've got up to scale data, which is very, very fine resolution, but it doesn't, you cannot basically, you cannot extrapolate from small scale to larger scales because, as we talked about earlier, everything changes. You also can't downscale because, as I said, you get this gold global template, which gets very simplified as you go through time. The problem, though, of course, is that most of the world is in what I call the messy middle. So another reason you talk about science for open spaces is how to reconfigure things such that basically you have a most of the world exists where we don't have data. So how do you rethink about the way you do science and policy to make that to address that gap? The other thing is a problem in policymaking in science is certainty. Adaptive management came out now about 40 years ago in the mid-70s to address this issue of lack of certainty. Well, we realize that so often there's very little certainty in policymaking. We're not well equipped to address uncertainty. In fact, most science models assume a fair amount of certainty, assumes that basically you pose a question because you're reasonably sure of the outcome. Well, even back in the 60s and 70s, people were already addressing these issues of how do you operate in the face of uncertainty? How do you know what you model to pick if you don't know it, even, you know, sort of what likely outcome might be? And increasingly, particularly things like climate change and fragmentation, the outcomes are quite unexpected. So what this kind of suggests then is that often policymaking exists at a range of scales, both spatial and temporal. You go from, it's almost like these Russian dolls, they're all occurring simultaneously. So you have a nested series of outcomes occurring simultaneously. And whereas historically, someone might say, a science might have only worked at this scale, only worked at that scale. Part of what we're saying is you actually have to work at multiple scales. So you may be interested in, say, an ecosystem at this scale here, but it's embedded in a social system at this scale, and your outcome may be a very particular paper for some prestigious journal down there. And so, again, you really operate at multiple scales simultaneously, whether you recognize it or not. So this means then you need to have a continuum of different approaches and really try and work much more effectively across systems. Going from historically, people used to compete. They would try and outdo another, compete for, say, you know, resources, whether it be financial, political, whatever. We now are going to much more of a collaborative approach, but the problem with collaboration is it's still, it can be fairly linear. I talked about that that sort of parallel play issue. The problem with so much of collaboration is that you're still really, you're cooperating, but you're not really getting that synergy that you do is integrate. So we're trying to move from here, from the collaboration, cooperation, to integration, and that requires, again, much more effective synergy between disciplines. So one way to do that is then to think about social design. Again, I really have realized more and more in my work that to get science right, to work at large scales, really it's not about statistics, not about the experimental design, the kind of things scientists think about. It's about social design. Things like having a foundation of common principles and values that allow people to reach common ground consensus. It's about having adaptive governance structures that provide institutional structure for adapting and change. And again, so often, again, another way to phrase this, people think that if they just have good statistics, if they just have a robust experimental design, they'll be able to solve complex problems. But actually, you got to take one step back farther and look at the institutional structure and realize if you don't get the institutional structure right, you can't do the science you want. And finally, of course, at really large scale, things need to be networked. You can't just work in one place. You have to work at several places. And a good example of that is I'll use from the Central Rockies, where a number of projects going on in parallel that operate and address different challenges or comparable challenges. For example, you go from Yellowstone National Park, which we have maybe the 2.2 million acre park isn't big enough. So that's embedded in about a 4 million acre ecosystem. And that requires a lot of sort of locally based collaborative processes that occur there. But that's not big enough because a lot of species like the bears and whatnot move across vast areas. So then you go, say, the Crown Continent, which is about 18 million acres, involves a number of tribes, involves a very rich set of players. But that's not big enough either, because species move across scales to even larger scales, such as the Yellowstone-Yukon Project, which essentially goes from Yellowstone Park all the way up to the Arctic. I sort of feel like that old Ginsu knife, or those ads back in the 70s and 80s that would say, but wait, there's more. I feel like that's the same thing here with the conservation. You go, okay, it's not, we started in the 80s with just the greater Yellowstone ecosystem, and that wasn't big enough. The bears were moving outside that. So then we went to larger systems, and we keep going up and up in scale, realizing you've got to work across these scales. But you can imagine at each of these scales requires different kind of governance, different kind of solutions. You know, here is just basically one park and surrounding lands. Here you've got two countries, you know, Canada and the U.S. You've got tribes. You've got different governments occurring. And then here you're going to all the way across, you know, totally different sort of climatic zones, et cetera. So that raises the question, well, how do you do that on the ground? I mean, what's her process you use to address that kind of complexity? And one nice thing is there are some good models out there from the social literature. One is something called collective impact, which was developed in the city of Cincinnati, where they realized that there were about 104 organizations all addressing childhood poverty. And they realized they're all fighting against each other and really working at cross purposes. And so what collective impact did was it generated a networked approach to problem solving in the social environment. Well, that approach is also equally useful for working with the social systems or science systems. And so, and some of the core areas are you need to have common agenda, you need to have common ground, you need to have common measures, you need to have mutually reinforcing activities, communications, and a backbone organization. And the key thing here really is that backbone organization really is that you need to have essentially an honest broker that's there to look across a suite of variables, a suite of entities, and bring them together, because the idea is to not, again, have them compete, but have them be basically have everyone's boat raised by having common ground. So to summarize this first part of the talk, the core, if there's nothing else I want to take away from this talk, it really is that I've really found increasingly in my work, when you're working at large scales, that basically the secret to success in some ways in large-scale ecological research is getting the social system back right. The secret to success in large-scale ecological is social systems is getting the science piece right. Again, let me rephrase that. Again, to get the science right, you got to get the social framework right. To get the social framework right, you've got to get the science right. They both really require each other. So, again, our old model of having these parallel disciplines doesn't work very well at these large scales because these are not discrete disciplines. They're a continuum. And, by the way, it's worth pointing out that this continuum is very much an issue of complexity in that you go from, in essence, social systems tend to be basically, they're immensely complex. And so one of the reasons why social science is often sort of criticized for being fairly nebulous or fairly not being quite quantifiable as physical science is because it's a heck of a lot more complex. For example, what it would take to compute or to estimate how you all got in this room would be impossible. You could never could do it. It's an unanswerable question. Yet, as I used earlier, the example of a set of questions that would let you get to the moon back, that's a fairly simple, straightforward question. You can answer that. So again, keep in mind that we often think about, yeah, and rocket science being very hard, social science being very soft, hard and soft science. Again, soft science is complex, hard science is relatively simple. And so, again, the quantification means that often you have to have much more complex, nuanced ways of addressing problems in the social realm because just, they're not amenable to simple, you know, kinds of problem solving you often have in physical sciences. So on the final part here, and I want to use a couple examples from California. I should say in the book I don't talk about these. These are projects that friends or colleagues work on. They're not projects I work on specifically myself, but they're nice examples of local things you all can relate to. And some really interesting, innovative work done in California. They're really experiments. One experiment is Tan Ranch Conservancy. How many of you have heard about this? Maybe. Oh, good, a few of you. So this is really set up to address the issue of the California condor. And it's a partnership of developers and conservation organizations where they set up this landscape it's basically cluster development, essentially at very large scales. They have some intensive development in some areas, but that then allows a coordinated protection of larger parts of the landscape. So it's really using that sustainable landscape or sustainable economic model I talked about earlier. But it does so in a really important place. It's you've got these, you know, Central Valley meets the Sierras, meets Mojave, meets the coastal zone. So you've got incredibly rich diversity of species coming together there. And again, it's this hybrid model of economics and rural development coupled with ecology and conservation. You also have, of course, an amazing number of diversity of species. You have some of the sort of rare subspecies of pronghorn. You've got the condors, which lizard that is, but, you know, rare species of dragonfly. So, again, there's a lot going on in this landscape, but there's also a lot going on socially. So, again, it's this balancing act between this Tan Ranch Corporation, which does the subdivision development, and they have a suite of human uses, and the challenge is then to sustain this working landscape. So that's one example of a fairly creative problem or creative solution to this problem of sustaining large landscapes long term. I think the jury's out as to whether it'll work, and, you know, in a century or two we might know. But it's an important first step in exploring how you take on other kinds of issues. Another one is this occurs just off the coast here. It's the Central Coast Groundfish Project. How many of you have heard of this? Have you heard of this? Okay. This is work started by the Nature Conservancy about a decade ago, and it's become a model globally. And one nice thing about fisheries is that they're already open landscapes, but they're right now we're in this process of ascribing property rights to these open commons. And so these landscapes are being divided up not by acres, but by basic permits and allocation. So what this project does is it basically sets a leasing project. Basically, you've got co-ops, and if you agree to follow certain kinds of less invasive fishery practices, you can have access to permits. At the same time, they get much more sophisticated monitoring going on. So it's a great way of both sustaining fisheries, sustaining fishermen, and experimenting with different kinds of science and marine harvesting techniques. Again, it's become a model. We used it in the Gulf of Maine. It's been used around the globe as a really nice example of how you have created partnerships between scientists and communities and conservationists. And again, like in the Tan Ranch example, you've got this immensely rich landscape or seascape out there that is conserved. So in closing, really we've got this paradigm shift that's going on, that's occurring in conservation anyway. And this actually is a slide that a friend of mine, Tom Olaf, who used to be basically lead scientist at Yellowstone, put together. But I like it because it kind of gets a lot of the same issues that I've grappled with in my work, which is as you're going from the old paradigm, which essentially was a complicated view of the world. We've talked about that, where systems were a lot of moving parts, but they had predictable outcomes, to a complex view of the world where there may even be fewer pieces, but the pieces interact in dynamic and unpredictable ways. Next, we're going from a place-based approach, historically in conservation. Let's say we're just going to serve that park or this reserve or that science here, that science there, to a resource base where the idea is, again, rather than asking, how do I conserve Yellowstone Park, you say, how big a landscape do I need to conserve, say, grizzly bear? And that's why you get from areas that are, say, go from being 2 million acres to being, you know, over 100 million acres. Another idea is being rather than being project-driven to being conservation-driven. Again, the idea is to not be have these institutional boundaries. You don't just say, oh, just because an area is a Park Service area or Bureau of Land Management, Forest Service area, that doesn't mean that it's big enough or useful for conservation. So you need to go up in size. Think about conservation design across a range of settings. Another transition has been from a field-based empirical approach to a model and projected approach. Again, this is part of that dynamics. This, of course, highlights part of the problem. We went from the scaled-up approach here to basically a downscaled approach here. The problem is that still most of the problems lie in the middle. And so that's a core area right now of science is how do you deal with that messy middle, that complexity that resides between those extremes that are relatively easy to quantify. Let's see, other things. You've got insular, carefully chosen partners in traditional model. You just play with whoever you want to play with, not other folks. To realize that you really have to have multiple partners, and I actually really need to reach out to those people who don't agree with you, things like Teon Ranch. I mean, you can't ignore development community. You have to reach out to those guys first because they really hold the cards. I mean, you can talk about all you like, but unless you really have the game-changing players in the room, even if you disagree with them, you're not going to make progress. Let's see. Again, we've gone from conserving species to conserving process, realizing that, for example, things like, grizzly bear in the Northern Rockies, or, you can't, if you can't preserve grizzly bear if you ignore the role of fire, or you can't conserve grizzly bear if you ignore the role of climate change. Likewise here, if you're dealing with, say, the impact of, preserving California condor, you can't just focus on condor. They don't exist in a vacuum. They exist in this landscape as all this other complexity. And so, again, you need to think about the processes that affect condor, that affect grizzly. And if you don't, then, this species model has not been very successful. Finally, you go from the historic range of variation to thinking about the future range of variation. This really speaks to the whole climate change issue that so often our models speak to the past. We say, okay, well, something didn't happen over the last 100 years, 200 years. It's not going to happen the next 100, 200 years. And that was always a dubious assumption. But it really doesn't work now with the rates of change. So again, how do you deal with that uncertainty issue I talked about? How do you deal with planning when you don't know it's going to happen and you only have a rough idea? So the models are helpful, but they're by no means a total predictor, which means you have to build in a lot more slack in the system. You have to assume a lot more naivete. You basically have to assume you don't know the answer. You have to assume the outcome is going to be a surprise. So how do you both plan for what you think is going to happen while also planning for surprise outcomes? And by the way, even historic range variation is fairly optimistic. In current planning or conservation planning over the last decade or two, even that was fairly rare. Finally, in the historically conservation science is often regulation-driven, and now it's collaboration-driven. The idea is that in the past, people would kind of say, okay, did I follow rule X, Y, and Z, and sort of check them off. And if you successfully follow the rules and regs, the outcome must soon be successful. Now we're realizing, actually, no. You have to develop a collaborative process, but I'd say you need to take it a step farther. Not only do you have to have a collaborative process in place, you actually have to have the successful collaboration. That's really hard because, again, successful collaboration takes decades, and a lot of what I talk about in the book is how you sustain collaboration, longer than the 3 to 5 years that, again, would be success under a typical funding model. So with that, I'll open up for questions. And again, I do apologize to those who are here that I've never had this timer issue before on, so I hope it wasn't too distracting. So I've tried to deal with that as best I could. But again, I hope it was reasonably coherent given the constraints.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is The Science of Open Spaces with Charles Curtin, Senior Fellow for the Center for Natural Resources, Environmental Policy, and from the University of Montana, Missoula. And now we are open now for our questions, and we do have a number of questions. Let me give you, let you know about the first one. Do you mind saying a bit more on how conservation, managing open spaces, can help fund rural development or create a sustainable rural economy? Concrete examples would be great.
Okay, great. So again, the question was, you know, linking, and this is actually an area I've been very interested in, which is how you link rural development conservation. And it's funny that there's still very much a barrier between the rural development community and the conservation community. They don't really interact much in this continent. Overseas, they have to. There's much more seamless interaction, but even there, there isn't so much. So we had a great study a few years ago of looking at rural development, following up on actually work that was done in Eastern Europe. There was a wonderful project called Symbio. What Symbio did was they, when the wall came down, they discovered that Poland was sitting on this amazing resources, which was de facto organic agriculture. Because they were basically the end of the road in the, you know, communist empire, they didn't get the tractors, didn't get the chemicals that the that, you know, other parts of the communist bloc got. So again, all of a sudden, and a friend of mine went over there in the early 90s, and basically he was a broker where he linked these people who had been by default not got tractors or chemicals with people, you know, a few hundred miles away, who desperately want food that hadn't had chemicals. And so we've been trying that model other areas of, for example, how you do, you basically approach where you basically, people have, say, predator-friendly beef where they will not, say, you know, shoot grizzlies or wolves. And in exchange, they can market it as predator-friendly beef, and then they get a premium for their cattle because they, you know, consumers will pay more for that. We'd like to take it a step farther with that Symbio model and actually say, okay, we'd like to develop, say, climate change adaptation agriculture, where, for example, you're not just, you're really thinking not about stock range variation, you're planning for the future. And so that funding would not only give a premium to the producer, part of it would also go back to helping out, support the science and the conservation to monitor that. And that's, because I think this great question really gets the crux of it, that, you know, if we're talking about decadal problems and we're in a world where you have to solve more and more problems with fewer and fewer resources, we've got to solve the economic piece. And so the crux of it, and it's, I mean, I'm an ecologist, right? But I realize that to get the science right is really an economic question. So how do you do that? And again, we can't rely on National Science Foundation, big donors, whatnot. We already know that that doesn't really work except for particular kinds of projects. The messy projects, there's really not a lot of potential to fund those because you don't get the kind of clean published results that, you know, are career enhancing and are secure stream of funding. So I hope that, who asked that question? Can I ask? Are they here? Did I get at your question?
Yeah, no, you did.
Okay.
So our response is you're asking for. Let me bring the mic to you.
No, it's fine. My question. I'm curious if you had any from, say, the Southwest or Texas, where I'm originally from.
Okay. Well, actually,
I hate to ask you again. Can you? Because we'll get it on the audio.
No problem. I was curious if you had any examples from the Southwest or from Texas, which is my home state.
Okay. No, great. And I actually worked in the book I talked about, I worked for more than a decade with a group called the Malapai Borderlands Group in eastern Arizona, southwestern New Mexico. And that was very much the challenge. And what I did there, one of my main projects, which I ran actually, was really cool. We ran the biggest ecological experiment on the continent was run not by university, not by, you know, Berkeley or Wisconsin or Davis, whoever. It was run by actually a consortium of ranchers. And we used basically social capital to allow us to go to a much larger scale. So I actually have an experiment I did for 12 years in that messy middle. And it was the social relationships and the social interactions that allowed us to work at large scale. So kind of the punchline there is that the idea is that the rancher said, you know, if we're going to the donor community, we're saying we think grazing is sustainable. But we better put our money where our mouth is and have someone actually study that. So what they said, and they had this wonderful phrase, was they said, live by the sword, die by the sword. He said, we're going to invest in the best science possible. And we'll prove, we're either going to prove that ranching is sustainable landscape or we're going to prove it isn't. But as one of my ranching friends said, if ranching is not sustainable that landscape, he'd rather be the first to know. So that's another example that you're going to talk about more in this book. But okay, I'll go on to some other questions here.
The next one is, any suggestions on how best to structure conversations, thank you, to get to a common agenda with diverse groups needed to solve these problems?
Okay, well, the glib answer is food. often, it's funny how people get together around, often around food, around, and that really just says community. And this Malpai Borderlands group I mentioned a minute ago was, they were masters at bringing diverse groups together. And what they did, they'd have community potlucks and they'd bring people in. They would also, they had do trail rides. By the way, another way is science. I mean, a phrase I often use is that science is too expensive to just get data. And it's an incredible opportunity to get, to really develop common ground. And a lot of the projects I've done, I really felt like the outcome, far more important than the data we got, was the sense of community. And so that those are all, so those are all core areas. But you're right, that is really, and that's a great example where we really need to draw on other disciplines. Ecologists aren't trained to do this. We really need to draw on social sciences, and there are a whole vast areas of people who do nothing but study that, need to draw on that literature as you're undertaking this kind of work.
No, the idea I had is I professionally work with organizations who use a process called scenario analysis, and that process involves imagining various different futures and then figuring out how you're going to get there, but you use a diverse group of people to create those futures. And then from that, you can get like a common agenda, common goals, but the idea is to move people, 10, 20 years out in the time frames that you're talking about. And as they work through the various scenarios, and this kind of cohesiveness actually develops.
Yes, that's a great example. And you see that now fairly often. For example, working with, I see examples in East Africa where there's rural development projects where you get tribal groups, for example, get together, talk about what they see as their common vision. But a piece, I think, where I try and take a step farther is that from a science standpoint, they're not just creating a joint vision. They're really creating a model. And I kind of talked about this in the book. They're creating a model of how the world works. And so much of my research as a scientist has been really to take this much richer, more diverse model of the way the world works than I ever could assemble or as scientists could ever assemble, and to respond to that. And so, again, another way to really rephrase that, because it's important. So often the models are developed by scientists. Well, scientists, they've not spent three generations on landscape. They may know the literature. They've got quite a sophistication. But as I talked about in the example of comparing the Santa Fe Institute with ecologists, or rather with ranchers, the ranchers often have a much richer, more nuanced worldview than scientists do, because they live it. They're there out there every day. And so often I look at myself as a translator. I take that really dynamic worldview a rancher has, and I transfer it into theory, scientific theory, that then can be tested. And so again, I feel like that's actually a more powerful model, because not only develop the common ground you asked about, you're also moving the science forward. And guess what? These guys have insights I or other colleagues would never have thought of. I mean, there's some things they will have thought they won't have either. But the combined impact of having local people on the ground and people from an academic setting is far more powerful than either one. And I believe strongly, and this has been kind of an undergirding of my career, is that actually you have much more sophisticated science when you combine those two. And so often we think about, oh, when you involve local people, you involve citizen science, it's kind of dumbed down, that's kind of lesser. But I would argue that actually it's a lot more sophisticated if you can then take cutting-edge theory and apply it to those ideas that those people who've lived decades or generations on a landscape have. So, yeah, great question.
Actually, that leads us into another similar question, not similar, but another question that is pertinent to, let's say, to the discussion we're having. Where does the American, and I think it's Prairie Association, am I right about that? Thank you. Fit in buying ranches, burning buildings, and returning bison to the plains? Are they collaborating with local communities and ranchers?
Great. Do you know that project well, or do you?
Well, I bought my sister and brother-in-law's ranch.
Oh, wonderful. It's up by Malta. This is a project up by in north central Montana, which is really a rewilding of the American prairie, and they're trying to put together pieces of this vast landscape in central Montana. It's really an ambitious project that's been going on, what, about 10, 15 years now? 15 years, probably? A really interesting, innovative project. Now, I'd say, in my own sense, I haven't worked directly with them. It's kind of a, sort of the outsider view that the strong parts of it are what I just talked about. They have this amazing vision of trying to piece together back the landscape at large scales. The drawback there is that a lot of the leadership is from the East. And if you know anything about Western ranches, when someone shows up in loafers and a, you know, whatever, it just doesn't go well. And so I think a lot of the reason why they've actually met with quite a bit of resistance, and I think it's less, again, this is an outside perspective, but my perspective is it's the resistance is less what they're selling than how they're selling it. And that, again, it is largely, the leadership of the organization is largely East Coast. It's largely East Coast elites. And this doesn't play well in Peoria to have people, you know, come in from the outside. And so I think it's really an inside-outside dynamic more than what they're actually doing. And so, like I said, I've talked a few times. I was hoping to consult with them because I feel like they actually could benefit from some of the perspective I've had because I work with ranchers much of my career. And what I would tell them is that, you know, there are certain things. You don't show up to a ranch in shorts. You don't do it. I mean, that's like that's like having a big sign in your back that says "tourist." I mean, you know, it just doesn't work. You don't show up with your hat turned backwards. That's really offensive to rural people. Having your hat, your baseball cap turned on backwards, that's saying I don't work. I mean, there's certain things that they're just really trip their triggers. And I don't know necessarily whether that group's not there, but I've seen other parts of the West where, again, I have my field staff said, I don't care if you're hot. You're going to wear jeans because people who work wear jeans. And subtle stuff. So I guess that's so really what you're asking to me is a much more important question or more general question, which is you got to meet people where they are. And I often look at collaboration as being a bit like a card game where no one shows their cards. And by the way, everybody's playing by a different set of rules. So everyone's basically looking for a different outcome. Success, the guy who's from the Forest Service, the guy who's the Yale-trained, you know, conservationist, the local rancher, success looks totally different to each one of those people. And so you've got to figure out, and I think that's where, you know, and American Prairie Preserve, they're learning. Actually, they've come a long way just in a few years I've watched them. But they're learning now that success is not what they think. Success is what the people they're buying land from, the local people think. And so how do you span that, or how do you have common ground? And that comes back to this gentleman's question earlier, which is how do you create those settings for getting common ground? So, yeah, I watched that one with great interest. And I do think that, I think where they're tripping up is not in the science, not in the policy. It's a social thing that they need a face they need a face that's local.
This is a similar question, but it raises the issue, I think, in a very important way. It's how do you address, it's three C's, continuum of complexity with collaboration. It seems that this is a nice thing to say, but how will we ever accomplish it?
Great, great question. Well, I mean, again, the glib answer is you have to read the book. But I'm teasing some. But that actually really is kind of the question of the book. I mean, that's really what I spent 20 years trying to figure out. And I've not figured out by any means, but there are some successful examples. What I found is there are a short list of things you see. Probably the one thing, and to kind of get to your question, is there's one key ingredient that makes all this work, and that's trust. If you don't trust, you've got nothing. And I think so often I see, and this is a great example of APR too, is that they start with thinking, you know, if we just do good work, if we just get in there and we do it, we'll get done, we'll succeed. Well, but they didn't build a trust first, and it takes a lot of patience to step back. And frankly, it's not really their fault. I talked about a 3 to 5 year solution. The donors, they want to see solutions tomorrow. And it takes a decade usually about to build trust. So there are certain things, again, some of our metrics are all wrong. The metrics shouldn't be things like how many acres you preserve this year, how much do you do next year. The metrics really are things like over a decade, and that curve I had of funding. You saw how it was smaller but stretched way out. We basically it takes a lot of patience to realize this is a marathon, it's not a sprint, and we treat these things like they're sprints. So there are some examples again. The Malpa Borlands Group, actually, we did succeed for about the first decade. It then ran into snags when the recession came along. But I think that group did have success for the first decade. In fisheries, New England and fisheries, there are some good examples. So there are some good examples out there. But it is it's a work in progress. And a lot boils down to, frankly, you got to ask the right question to begin with. And really that big, long slide I had, the second to last one, really what it's saying all really boils down to, you got to phrase the question. You got to ask an appropriate question. If you ask the wrong question, you get the wrong answer. We don't often know what those answers are, but we do know that it's about basically, you know, working long enough and large enough scales to have things work.
This one is a major question, if not the fundamental question, which is probably the elephant in the room. Let me read this right. We've addressed research as a scientific endeavor. Which you have actually explained, but really research in order to be research has to address the social involvement first. So how do we create a new structure for research that can address the problems but take as a fundamental premise the interaction with the social problem or the social viewpoints and the researchers' viewpoints. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I think so. Rephrase, I think what you're saying is, how do you integrate across disciplines, recognizing that you've got, I mean, both simple things. For example, natural scientists write papers. By and large, our route to success is through career building, is through papers that are typically less than 4,000 to 6,000 words. Social scientists write books. Their past success is through book writing. And that makes a huge difference because, for example, natural scientists can write all the books they want. It's not going to improve their career. We're not judged on that. So there are these simple things. You need to find that common ground between these disciplines. And I do think at the core of it, a lot of it is just breaking down disciplinary boundaries. And that's already beginning to happen. But what I'm trying to show here is that it's just much more than that parallel play. It can't be people, again, you know, the social scientists here and the biologists here. They have to integrate. And so they need to do things like write papers together, need to do studies where, for example, I mean, another way to phrase this, it's so much the successful outcome of social system is often ecological, and ecological system is social. And that really gets the heart of it. For example, do you want to know whether social system is successful or not? So often in the past, people just say, did people meet? Did they meet 30 times? Okay, check. It was successful. Well, no. If they didn't do viable science, it wasn't successful. So it may take actually quantifying whether it's successful natural science to tell you whether the social system worked. The opposite is also true. You want to know whether your science is viable, whether it's going to last for, say, the 2 decades you need to have a logical, a viable outcome to address climate change. Look at your social system, because you already know if you don't have a viable social system, you're never going to have a viable science system. Again, it comes with that T word, trust. You can right off the bat, you know, I know from my work that if there isn't trust, if there isn't common ground built up, no amount of wishing is going to make for good science. It can't happen any more than you can sort of drive a car without wheels on it. I mean, it just won't go. You can fake it for a little while, but you're not going to get a long-term outcome. Okay, I don't know if there any other.
Well, this one is similar, so I'm going to use the words we used before. It's do you think there will be a new structure for research? Will that be created or developed within the next 5 to 10 years, a different structure that we're working under than we are now?
Oh, great question. And, you know, again, that's something I've been spent a lot of my career on, is trying to figure out different ways of undertaking research. And one of the things we did was this work with the Malpai Borderlands group, where we did collaboration, where, again, it was a win-win that we got these vast landscapes and these vast projects to work on, this 10,000-acre project. The ranchers got really good data on is ranching viable or not. So I think it's really reaching out, partnering with non-traditional funders or non-traditional partners. The kicker is the funding piece. If anything, the funding world's become more conservative over the last decade or two than it was. When we began in the 90s, a lot of the donors had these basically senior staff who were willing to take risks. They were secure. That's really changed. It's now much more junior people. The funding world is much more risk averse. So again, it boils down to things like, really, to me, that question, who asked that?
It wasn't signed.
Okay, it doesn't matter. But basically, that to me is a funding question, largely. Really, what you're asking is, how do you get long-term funding by people who are willing to take risks? And that's why, again, it's so important to get back to this sort of complexity framework, because complexity gets at the heart of what drives the system. So you get beyond the superficial to ask, okay, what really makes it work? And I'd say in that question, it's really a funding question. How do you get 2 decades of funding sustainably done? And I'd say that means then you need to have actually an economic model that has feedbacks like the predator-friendly beef example, where you basically have to build in a funding source. Because if you cannot rely on traditional funding sources to maintain that long enough, it just simply isn't going to happen under the current model.
Unfortunately, we have reached that point when that is our last question, and we really are glad and happy that you've been able to join us. This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is The Science of Open Spaces with Charles Curtin, Senior Fellow for the Center for Natural Resources, Environmental Policy, University of Montana, Missoula. Charles's book is The Science of Open Spaces, Theory and Practice for Conserving Large Complex Systems, Island Press Publisher. A big thanks you to Charles Curtin for his work and the program tonight. Thank you, Charles, and thank you for being in San Francisco. And our thanks also to the Island Press for sponsoring this program. Many thanks to our wonderful audience here and on the radio and the internet, and let's have an applause for this really good audience and the questions they've answered. You can find our programs on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. Click on our website for multimedia access to programs, current news feeds, streaming audio, radio schedules, and 230 radio stations on national radio networks. Also find audio and videotapes and free weekly podcasts and archived programs. This program was sponsored by the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum, Science and Technology Member-Led Forum, Gerald Harris, who is with us tonight, and Business and Leadership Member-Led Forum, Kevin O'Malley, who was also chair, as I mentioned, of the Business and Leadership Program, and was also co-sponsored by Island Press. Please join us for our last environmental program for spring 2016. On Monday, June 6th, Adriana Quintero, Director and Founder of Voices Verdes and Director Partner Engagement from the Natural Resources Defense Council, will talk about environment and climate action, priority for Latinos and Latinas. Please join us. And don't forget to look for our 2016 fall programs. They'll be coming up, the first one at the beginning, at the end of August, and we hope to see you then, too. This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. Thank you for being with us. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.